They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
A little bit of healthcare, the business of politics in Arizona, and diversity on the TV from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, it is the 1st of November. Glad, as always, you could be with us, everybody. Obamacare has been in the news of late, politically, of course, on the campaign trail, but practically, too, in headlines about premium payments under the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment for the Obamacare exchanges starts today, the sign-up period, that is. But here's the thing. About half of all Americans get their health care insurance through their jobs, about which we have heard precious little the past few weeks. So, with open enrollment starting today at many workplaces as well, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts us off with this look at the employer-provided insurance market.
So it's that time of year again, when those of us lucky enough to get insurance through our jobs re-up and brace ourselves for a premium increase, because every year they go up for a number of reasons. One, the cost of health care is rising, and that's partly because hospitals have merged. There's strength in numbers, says Cynthia Cox at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
They may be able to have more negotiation power with insurers and thus negotiate higher prices for hospital services.
Drug prices are also increasing. Add it all up, and here's what you get.
Last year, insurance premiums for a family of four were about $18,000.
Zach Cooper is a health economist at Yale. He says for that amount of money,
people are more or less buying a new car for their family every year.
So if you could buy a new car with what you're spending on health insurance, are you getting a Cadillac plan? Nope. That's just for basic coverage. And chances are your copays and deductibles are rising. That's because insurers and employers are shifting more of those costs onto workers. Linda Blumberg of the Urban Institute says that's cutting into doctor visits.
So if it costs you more to go, you're going to be, you know, more reluctant to go to the doctor than you were if the copayment or the coinsurance was lower.
Of course, sometimes you do need to go to the doctor, but fewer visits are keeping healthcare costs from rising even faster. In fact, Blumberg says the cost of the insurance we get through work is up less than 4%. It rose closer to 7% in the early to mid-2000s. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Earl Long, a three-time governor of the great state of Louisiana, said this once. Don't write anything you can phone. Don't phone anything you can talk. Don't talk anything you can whisper. Don't whisper anything you can smile. Don't smile anything you can nod. Don't nod anything you can wink. Had he been alive to see email, Long surely would have been horrified. All the email hacks this election cycle have raised awareness in corporate America about vulnerability. But Marketplace's Andy Baxter reports that a lot of cybersecurity when it comes to emails hinges on employees' common sense.
Think of all the times you've emailed a colleague instead of walking over to say something, and you start to appreciate how big a role email plays in the American workplace. Ditching it? Not really feasible.
It would be like telling employees, you know, don't talk in the hallways.
Jules Polonetsky heads up a think tank called the Future of Privacy Forum. He says for most companies, email is still the lifeblood, but it has a lot of vulnerabilities.
There's real risk that it could be intercepted if your employees are using Wi-Fi at a coffee shop or if an attacker figures out how to access messages as they flow through the internet.
using something called end-to-end encryption keeps that from happening. Polonetsky says strong passwords can help make corporate emails more secure. Ditto for having a second form of authentication, like a code. But cybersecurity expert Aviva Leighton at Gartner says criminals know companies are putting that stuff in place. So the crooks are doing things like researching employees and sending them legitimate-seeming emails with links, which employees then click, potentially downloading malware.
Criminals are going to these kind of social engineering attacks because banks and others are putting up really good controls. But you can always get people to do the wrong thing.
So companies really need to focus on educating employees, according to cybersecurity expert Peter Swire.
If we shift to a different mechanism, that mechanism will get exploited as well.
If we move beyond email somehow, humans are still the weak links. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
There are 23 women running companies that are listed in the S&P 500 stock index. You do the math, that is bad enough. But there's new research out that shows women in C-suites are treated much differently by the press than their male counterparts are. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports that women are much more likely to be called out for bad leadership in news stories when a company hits a rough patch.
Filed this story under the damned if you do, damned if you don't heading. A new report from the Rockefeller Foundation analyzed more than 100 news articles about 20 CEOs over 15 years and discovered this disturbing chestnut.
80% of the stories about female CEOs involved in a crisis cited the CEO as the source of blame.
Laura Gordon is a managing director at the Rockefeller Foundation. That statistic compares to just 31% that blame male CEOs for a company's performance. Gordon says unconscious bias might be a factor, or the fact that there just aren't that many female CEOs, which makes them stand out as targets.
I think the broad takeaway is that the media's coverage of CEOs and women in particular, women CEOs, really matters.
And in reality, failing is actually a big part of becoming a good CEO.
The resilience is the great hallmark of leadership. A lot of women aren't given that chance.
Jeff Sonnenfeld is a senior associate dean at the Yale School of Management. He says women are also more likely to be brought in when a company is already in crisis. The so-called glass cliff faced by people like Mary Barra at GM or Marissa Meyer at Yahoo. And then there are cases like Ellen Kuhlman's at DuPont.
She had two bad quarters, and that was a total return over 5 years. Two bad quarters. The board lost its nerve, in part because of unfair, wilting public media pressure.
The best place to start creating gender parity, says Sonnenfeld, would be to increase the number of women on corporate boards where the majority of CEOs get plucked. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, tell you what, I'm going to read you a list of things. You pick which one you like as the cause of today's sad music, all right? There is the election. There's the Fed meeting today and tomorrow. There's corporate news. You pick them. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Businesses investing in the UK right now are to some degree rolling the dice, seeing as how the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union are still way up in the air. The Japanese car giant Nissan, though, is okay with that. It announced last week it's going to build two new models in the UK in spite of potential tariffs on cars that it might export from Britain to continental Europe post-Brexit. This being Brexit, though, there is controversy, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
If Nissan had decided not to build its two new models in Britain, that would have been a blow. Its factory in the depressed northeast of England employs 7,000 people. 28,000 more work for component suppliers. Prime Minister May was delighted by the Nissan decision.
This is fantastic news. This is a very important commitment of investment here in the UK. I think it shows the strength of our economy. We've been showing Nissan and others that we are committed to getting the best possible deal from the future relationship that we will be negotiating with the European Union.
But barely a month ago, the Nissan boss was threatening to pull investment from Britain. He feared that Brexit could mean tariffs of up to 10% on the 250,000 cars a year he exports from here to continental Europe. Then, 2 weeks ago, he met the Prime Minister and he emerged all smiles. Opposition economic spokesman John McDonnell believes the government has struck a secret deal with Nissan.
But does this mean the government is going to do deal by deal, company by company, or area by area? We just don't know. We can't go on like this. There needs to be a coherence to our negotiations.
Nissan and the government deny there's been a secret deal, but clearly Nissan has been reassured. How exactly? Has it been offered tax breaks to compensate for any tariffs or special research grants? Free marketeers like Philip Booth of the Institute of Economic Affairs are getting nervous.
I really don't think it's for the government to be trying to favour one company or another company or one industry over another industry. That really is a licence for vested interests to be threatening to leave and so on in order to get favours from the government.
The government recently made two big business decisions that it was obviously uncomfortable with, allowing the Chinese to take a stake in Britain's nuclear industry and supporting a plan for another runway at Heathrow Airport. In its eagerness to make a success of Brexit, to show that Britain is open for business, has the British government become more open to economic pressure? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I was at a conference up in Silicon Valley last month, conversations with people in the internet industry. I talked to Susan Wojcicki. She's the CEO of YouTube. We aired that one last week. The policy side of the digital economy was there as well, including Penny Pritzker. She's the Secretary of Commerce. We've had the Secretary on the program a couple of times, and our conversation this time around was about the government's increasing role in digital commerce and whether her department and the government in general weren't a little late to the game.
Yes and no. We uniquely are not your regulator. We are uniquely can be at the Department of Commerce the voice of industry in the conversation about privacy or cybersecurity or, encryption versus law enforcement.
You'll understand if a lot of the companies out there say, whoa, hey, government's not necessarily our friend when it comes to privacy and law enforcement and cybersecurity.
Right, but there are different voices and different groups in government.
Do you think companies want help in the digital economy?
Well, I think that help isn't the right question.
Okay.
To me, the question is, let's go to cybersecurity.
Okay.
To solve the cybersecurity challenge that we face, we have got to collaborate, the public and private sector. At this point, we have private sector entities that are having to defend themselves against nation states right now.
Yeah.
An IV today is networked. How'd you like to be up on an IV and somebody hacks into your IV? Not so exciting and doesn't give you a lot of confidence. We need to make sure police cars aren't hacked into. We need to make sure, these are real everyday problems that need to be solved.
How much do you worry that the American public is getting numb, really, to the idea of being hacked and, oh, God, they got my credit card and Chase is going to send me a new one and it's my fourth in 2 years?
First of all, if you actually look at the surveys, they're not numb. I saw one recently, 45% of people are hesitant to use their credit cards online. I talked to a venture capitalist yesterday who said, this is my biggest concern is, with the hackings, will people stop being willing to do commerce online and put their information online? So I am worried that we are in a race to solve these problems because we have set our economy on a course that it runs on a digital backbone, and we need to make sure that it's secure.
We were talking backstage, and I'm not telling any tales out of school here, but we were talking about self-driving cars. And you brought up self-driving trucks and how you are worried about the truck drivers who at some point will be displaced and they won't have jobs. It seems to me that that's the logical end result of the digital economy, that we will eventually get to the place where those 3 million people won't have jobs. How do you steal the American public, getting it back again to the conversation of the political environment today, how do you steal the American public to know and accept and understand that that's coming and we need to get on board?
Well, I think that...
And I know that's a very politician question and you're not technically a politician, but it's kind of your job.
So answer the question.
Please, Madam Secretary.
Thank you. Thanks, Kai. Look, these are very serious issues that I think that we need to be talking about. If we're going to dislocate 3 million truck drivers, how are we going to deal with that as a country?
You've got 3 months and a couple of days till you're out of a job.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with yourself, number one? And number two, what will eat at you that you have left undone?
So I think that one of the things that we at the Department of Commerce have done is we've laid a foundation with all of you to have a strong digital agenda and a data agenda and an innovation agenda. But I think the work is really nascent. I mean, if I were putting it in startup language, I think we're in year two of a startup, you know, and we're not earning revenue yet, and we certainly haven't got it all figured out.
Penny Pritzker, the Secretary of Commerce. Madam Secretary,
thank you very much.
Thank you,
Kai.
If you want to take a listen to that Susan Wojcicki interview, it's on our most recent Corner Office podcast. It was pretty good, if I say so myself.
Coming up, there are more different kinds of black people doing more different kinds of things on TV.
Television and movies, too. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so what's your reason? What'd you pick? The Dow Industrial's off 105 points, 0.5%, 18,037. The NASDAQ down 35.6%, 5153. The S&P 500 declined 14.6%, 2111 there. Archer Daniels Midland profits topped expectations on a projected record U.S. harvest of corn and soybeans this year. Archer grew 7.2%. CSX, which might be hauling a lot of that grain around on its trains, was off 0.3%. Pfizer said it's going to end clinical trials on a new cholesterol-lowering injection, which Wall Street had once thought could be a $20 billion drug. Ouch. Pfizer shares down 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down just a fraction, 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The Real Clear Politics poll average for Arizona has Donald Trump up 1.5%, to be expected perhaps, in a state that's voted Republican in every presidential election since 1952, except for one time when another Clinton won it by a hair, 1996, that was. This year, though, Arizona Republicans have a fight on their hands. Just last week, in fact, Hillary Clinton was ahead. So now, as Jimmy Jenkins reports from KJZZ in Phoenix, both parties are spending big to get out the vote.
Until this year, you wouldn't find Arizona and battleground state in the same sentence. For national races, it's historically been a safe space for the GOP. Neither party would admit past complacency, but both Democrats and Republicans here have had record fundraising years, suggesting there's more money being spent on this federal election cycle in Arizona than ever before. State Democrats have raised more than $1.5 million this year, and they're using the money to reach out to voters.
Yeah, everything's all hands on deck right now.
Enrique Gutierrez is the communications director with the state Democratic Party. Democrats have more than 160 paid staffers running 32 statewide offices in Arizona, their largest presence ever in the state. Gutierrez says the national party helped pay for the expansion.
In other cycles, sometimes our resources are pulled out of Arizona and into, like, you know, states like Nevada or Colorado, where it's very competitive. And now what we're seeing now in this cycle, it's a difference where we're seeing, you know, those resources come into Arizona.
The Democrats are investing heavily in their ground game. Their main focus? Early voting.
We're asking you if you can make mailing in your ballot a priority to make sure that it gets counted on time.
Volunteers like Claudia Hallworth are phone banking in Phoenix to make sure voters that requested early ballots are filling them out and sending them in. More than 2 million Arizonans requested early ballots this year. Hallworth says they have lots of questions about the relatively new voting method.
What is the deadline for mailing? Can I drop it off at my ballot place? What if I drop it off at a ballot place that's not my ballot place? Will it still count?
Across town at the Republican Party headquarters, volunteers are filling plastic bags with voter information that they'll hang on doorknobs in a neighborhood canvas. Robert Graham is chair of the Arizona Republican Party. He oversees 21 field offices in the state and just over 100 paid staffers.
The reason why that might be perceived as being light here is because the Republican Party here has been very self-sufficient, and it takes the pressure off other states.
Graham says even though it's a close race, asking the RNC for money would take away from its efforts in places like Florida and Ohio. He says they've raised more than $3 million in Arizona, and they're spending the majority of it on direct mail and phone calls to get out the vote.
Phone calls, you spend 2 to 3 cents a call, and we've done a million something phone calls, so that gives you a feel for where we are.
And of course, they're spending on digital ads and social media, but there's money going to traditional messaging as well. At this Get Out the Vote event in September, the campaign handed out more than 30,000 yard signs.
Taking this big one home. There you go. I told you it'd fit.
Alex John and his sister are stuffing a massive 4-foot by 8-foot Trump sign into their parents' SUV.
We're going to hang it up, and we took 10 yard signs, and I'm going to spread it out with all my family members.
Graham says engaging voters on every level is especially important in a state where voters aren't used to such a tight race.
And so we have to continue to remind them to vote. We have to continue to remind them to engage in the process. But I don't think we have to regroup people just because they become complacent. I think right now people know there's a real fight here in Arizona.
And as the demographics here continue trending younger, more liberal, and increasingly Latino, it's a fight that could bring a hefty price tag for both parties for years to come. In Phoenix, I'm Jimmy Jenkins for Marketplace.
We talk to Wesley Morris every now and then. He's a critic at large for the New York Times. We call him up to talk about popular culture and movies and race in this society, a bunch of other stuff as well. He had a piece in the Times magazine last weekend. It was titled "The Last Taboo: Why Pop Culture Just Can't Deal with Black Male Sexuality." We're going to take that. We're going to riff on it a little bit and talk about African Americans on the big and small screens, including in a film out just last week. It's called Moonlight. Wesley, it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
I want to start with this movie that you talk about in your magazine piece this weekend, but which is, you say, in the course of that conversation, you say it's just an exquisite film.
In terms of what the story actually is doing is pretty simple. It's just a story of this one person's life over the course of about 15 or 20 years. And it's about him trying to figure out or not figure out his sexuality. But the movie is sort of interested in a lot of other ideas around black life and black culture, basically.
What's interesting is you waited until the end of that paragraph to get to the fact that it's a black kid and a black man talking about sexuality on the screen.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was interesting to try not to make this argument about this movie that some people are trying to make that it's universal, because that is in some ways true, but it is also very, very specifically about being a black male mm-hmm. and how a certain aspect of black male identity gets constructed around the expectations of what a black male is supposed to be, regardless of what his sexuality is.
Pull it back for me then, would you, from this film and from movies specifically, and let's talk a little bit here about blacks in popular culture and the way they are portrayed, not necessarily on the big screen, but on the small screen. This is a good time, you have said in the Times and other places, to be black and on television.
Yes. I think there are two things that can explain this. I think thing number one, there are more channels to put programming on than there ever previously have been. Mm. And I just don't think there are enough white people to be on all those channels. So invariably, somebody is going to just have to let some people of color on TV. It's more that there are more different kinds of black people doing more different kinds of things on TV, as opposed to the David Simon version of the black experience,
which
pretty much limits it to cops and criminals,
right.
Which, you know, I love The Wire, but you can do The Wire, you can do Empire. You can do Queen Sugar. You can do Atlanta. You can do How to Get Away with Murder. I mean, there are a lot of different things you can do.
And the thing about those shows that you just ticked off, and these are your words, not mine, right? They make integration look like it's supposed to be. They don't make integration look like work, you know?
Right. And so I think what happens now is these shows aren't even arguing for integration. Some of them are just entirely black.
Yep.
There's no white best friend. There's no white infrastructure in which these characters work. It's just an entirely black world, and it also feels authentic to the places in which some of these shows are set.
How come television does this so much better than the movies do? So at least lately?
I think a lot of that has to do with the priorities of the movie industry. The idea of a show like Atlanta existing at the movies is harder to understand or to see. Now, there's a monthly Kevin Hart movie.
Yeah, there is. That's right.
But it can't be Kevin Hart all the time either. Right. Every season of television brings about 15 people I had never heard of before. I mean, Queen Sugar that comes on OWN, it's Oprah Winfrey, it's Ava DuVernay's soap opera about a family in New Orleans. And there are so many great black actors who have just been, I mean, the only word for them is journeyman. They've been working for a long time and have never had parts as juicy as the ones they have on this show.
They're the overnight successes that took 20 years, right?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Wesley Morris is a critic at large for the New York Times. I cannot recommend to you highly enough his piece in the New York Times magazine this past Sunday. It's called The Last Taboo. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Kai.
Final note on the way out today, a thought or two about direct democracy. Californians are going to vote on 17 ballot measures next Tuesday. Residents of San Francisco have an additional 25 to consider, which for those San Franciscans voting by mail means each ballot return envelope could weigh as much as 4 ounces and, depending on how the ballots themselves are folded, cost the city $1.57 apiece. Never fear, though, the city has prepared a 2-minute video on how to fold those ballots most effectively and, one supposes, cheaply. All right, so here's the answer with Wall Street, by the way. It was the election, because the economy didn't change overnight, right? The Dow off 200 points at one point. The Dow off 105 at the bell, 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 35 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 off 14 points, 0.6% there as well. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team is Nishar Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.